I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Welcome to the heart of summer. I'm your host, Francis Lamb, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Sweltering Sun and Disgusting Humidity. Look, I've never really been a summer person. It's something I basically had to make peace with and try to make the most of, which mostly means embracing salads and grilling as a lifestyle. Which brings us to today's show. We're checking in with some of our favorite cooks on what they're making this summer. It's like an all-star cookout with folks like Bon Appetit's Andy Baragani, The Washington Post's Mara Judkiss, Lon Lam from America's Test Kitchen has dessert covered, and Sheila Prakash from The Kitchen is mixing the drinks. And we're going to get started with best-selling author Alison Roman. If you are a home cook who has spent any kind of time on the internet, chances are you've made one of her recipes. Maybe it's her salted chocolate chip shortbreads, a.k.a. the cookie, or her chickpea and spinach stew, a.k.a. the stew. Like, so many of her recipes go viral, she is like a recipe disease factory. But in a good way, in a good way. And the thing is, as delicious as her food is, her recipes are always designed with maximum chill. Always fewer steps than you think, always super non-fussy, and her slogan is, I will never ask you to dirty another dish unless absolutely necessary. So naturally, we wanted to check in with her to see what she's cooking this summer. Hey, Alison Roman.
Hi, Francis Lamb.
I am so happy to be here with you, and it's getting a little schwitzy out there.
Yeah,
but
it's steamy.
I'm thinking it's a good thing, because it means summer cooking.
That's right.
What do you like to cook this summer?
You know, I sort of have a policy where I try to spend as little time in the actual kitchen as possible in the summertime. So I'm a big fan of grilling. And the problem is that I don't own a grill because I don't have outdoor space. I've been told that I can't legally place a mini Weber grill on my fire escape. So I don't do that.
Never done it.
Wouldn't admit it on the radio if I did.
Why would you?
But I'm like a big fan of sort of prep in the kitchen and cook literally anywhere else. And that can mean grilling or eating a lot of no cook things. So I'm sort of I will bring a cutting board to the park is like how seriously I take this. And I mean it when I say, get out of my kitchen. I don't have AC in there and it gets just too hot. So it's mostly some combination of a grilled meat, a grilled or raw vegetable, and then something in which to eat it. And that can be a bun or a tortilla or flatbreads or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Do we want to go for the grill first or do you want to go for the vegetables first?
That is up to you. This is your rodeo. I'm just here. I'm just visiting.
Okay, let's wrestle up some animals. Let's wrestle up some animals, and we're gonna put them on the grill.
Yeah.
What did you just catch?
I probably am grilling something like boneless short ribs, hanger steak, chicken thighs, but probably I'm like a red meat griller. I love something that I can cook really hot and really fast and have it be very rare inside. That's sort of my dream. I feel like that type of meat and eating goes really well with anything. And it's sort of the time of year where you can buy those tougher cuts of beef that are really meant to be cooked really briefly over the grill, like super hot, get them charred, and then sliced super thin. So flank steak, things like that. But also, I'm a big fan of those cuts that are typically reserved for braising. So I like to take pork shoulder and cut those into steaks about, an inch thick, let's say, on the thick side and, you know, a half inch thick on the thin side.
Mm-hmm.
And I can marinate them at home and then grill them outside or just season them with salt and pepper. But those types of really fatty cuts that we typically only think of for winter braising, I love cooking on the grill and eating rare and with like lots of lime and herbs and things like that.
They're so interesting.
Yeah, they're so good. And I feel like that's something that I picked up like anytime I go to Korean barbecue or something like that, where they bring you those really fatty cuts and they're just sliced thinly, but they have better flavor and more fat. And that's all I'm really interested in.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because like our thing, we're like, oh, these are braising cuts. Like literally people will refer to them as braising cuts, but
right. You
can totally grill them if you mitigate the toughness just by slicing it thin.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like that's all you had to do.
Yeah. So those right now I'm really crushing on the boneless short rib and the pork shoulder as hot and fast grilling types of meat.
Mm.
I also love hot dogs.
Hot dogs. Luckily, we just had a 20-minute conversation about hot dogs, so you're going to have to listen to this podcast.
Well, it looks like I'm going to because I'm a huge hot dog enthusiast.
And what goes next to them?
Any vegetable that I can find. I pretty much will always do something like scallions or spring onions because I like to eat those just kind of as is, but they're also great chopped up and mixed in with some olive oil and herbs, like almost like a salsa verde.
Like a super easy salsa. Like
Yeah, literally just like an oily, limey scallion, charred scallion sauce.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and they cook super quickly. And then sort of anything else, I have a few vegetarian friends, and it's like if they see one more portobello mushroom, they're going to kill me. So I've sort of pivoted to a bit more interesting vegetables like eggplants and other squashes that typically kind of don't see a ton of play on the grill, but are really great. Radishes, kind of any – if it's a vegetable, I'm going to try to grill it. Grilled carrots, let me just say, are such a delight. They are so legit, and they're so easy and quick to grill. But they, you know, there's something that happens to a carrot on the grill where the sugars caramelize and they get really, really blackened and the insides get tender that just cannot happen in the oven. And typically I'm like a equal opportunist, and I'm like, you can roast it or grill it. Both are great. But with a grilled carrot is truly transcendent and probably something that nobody – or fewer people probably think to put on the grill.
Yeah, because I think you think it's thick, it's hard, it's going to take a long time to cook.
Yeah, I think you just think, you're either going to crudité it or you're going to roast it. And I think people don't really think of a carrot as like a summer vegetable. But if you go to a farmer's market in the dead of summer, I swear it's like 80% carrots. It's like, that's all they have. They must be very easy to grow. I don't know. It's just, it's a carrot festival.
I love how like... I don't know. Like, I think there's a sense of like Alison Roman, like her recipes are like really fresh. They're really like a lot of them really produce oriented. Like she must know her farmers like the back of her hand. She knows everything about. She's like, I don't know. Maybe the carrots are easy to grow.
I don't know. How hard is it to grow a carrot? Never asked. I don't know. I'm assuming not that hard. Okay. But
so salad-y things.
Salad-y things. Yeah, I am a big salad person. I'm not really a salad for dinner person unless there is, you know, a protein associated with it. I feel like, you know, a fridge clean out salad is a bit different of a story. But if I'm going for it and making a composed salad, I want it to feel like essentially a meal. Mm-hmm. And for me, that means that I'm probably putting like potatoes in my salad or shrimp or chicken or soft jammy eggs and tons of herbs and something crunchy. And I've got a few jars of like crushed nuts with spices or salted toasted nuts that I keep in the freezer that I use sort of as crouton. I joke that crunch is my favorite flavor, even though it's obviously not a flavor. But I'm a huge texture person, and my salad has to be, you know, ridiculously crunchy.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. Someone on Twitter the other day was saying like, oh, like I really want to make more salads at home. Can someone tell me a good dressing? And I didn't want to be that guy, but I was kind of like, I don't think it's about the dressing.
It's not about the dressing.
And I think it's having crunchy things.
Yeah. And here's also a secret. I never make dressings. There's like one dressing I'll make and that involves tahini because you can't just drizzle tahini on something. You kind of need to transform it. I feel like that's another thing is I'm not a creamy dressing person. If I were to make a dressing, it wouldn't be creamy unless it's tahini. But when I dress salads, I do, you know, I'll get everything in the bowl and then I'll just assault it with a ridiculous amount of lemon. That's probably my number one choice of acid in a salad. And then I season it with salt and pepper and then I taste it. And then I think, okay, does it need more salt? Does it need more lemon? And once it's exactly where I want it to be, which is like borderline too acidic and like maybe too salty, that's when I drizzle it with olive oil. And within the salad, I'll, you know, have some thinly sliced shallot or scallion or grated garlic or something. So I sort of take the components of what one would do for a vinaigrette or a dressing and I just apply them individually to the salad. I feel like each thing gets seasoned a lot more intensely and a lot more intentionally when you leave the fat out and use that to finish it.
Oh, interesting. Cool. And let's talk about sweet things.
Sweet things.
Because you started this life as a pastry chef, yeah?
I did, yeah. This crazy life. I did start as a pastry chef, yeah. Well, and in my defense, it was because it was the only job open they had in the restaurant I wanted to work at. Mm. So I went in and I said, I want to work in a restaurant. I want to be a chef. And they said, well, unfortunately, we only have one position open and it's in our pastry department. And I said, I'll take it. So that's how I became a pastry chef. Up. It was the only thing available.
But in the summer... Especially if you're home, you know, people are thinking, well, how do you make sweet things without baking if you're avoiding your oven entirely?
Yeah, you know, you don't. And that's why I always thought it was funny that the middle of summer is pie season because your oven's on for like 2 hours, essentially. But I also have to remember that most people, I'm assuming, have central AC. Like, they're not sweating to the oldies in my fourth floor walk-up with me. So for me personally, do I want to be baking? No, but that has probably more to do with my lack of airflow in my kitchen than anything else. So it's tough. I think, you know, years of working in the editorial world, that was sort of always the question, like, are people turning their ovens on in the summer? And the answer is absolutely they are.
Yeah.
Because most people have AC.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't actually matter when it's always 71 degrees.
It's only you fools who all live in New York
exactly.
and have these, like, janky apartments.
We're like, nobody's using their oven. It's like, well, actually, most people are. No. We're not because we're insane because we live here.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of really great frozen type things that are easy to do. I'm not the kind of person that's going to own like a popsicle mold just because I own too many things and I simply cannot own another thing in my kitchen, especially. So, but that's the type of thing where if you have a blender, you can like puree up some fruit and add some sugar to taste and freeze it. And I'm sure it would be delicious.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the life that I'm living.
Sure.
But if that's the life you're living, I want to come over
Live
and
it.
Have some of those popsicles.
Live it to the max.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Allison. Invite me to a barbecue, please.
I would absolutely love that. It would be my honor. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. That was Allison Roman, author of the cookbook Dining In and the soon-to-be-published Nothing Fancy. For her recipe for short ribs with quick kimchi and sesame salt, you go to splendidtable.org. And let me just clarify for her. She does not actually eat her grilled pork shoulder rare, but a thin-cut short rib or flank steak, yeah, just char it and go. And speaking of charring, let me turn you on to a technique that totally remade grilled zucchini for me. Because, I mean, honestly, history has not been kind to the grilled zucchini, I don't think. Not since the 90s when every sad vegetable platter pressed watery, limp versions of it into service. My wife can't even look at it anymore because she's a semi-vegetarian and so she had to eat it for 15 years. But a couple of years ago, the chef Ashley Christensen, incredible chef, turned me on to her way of grilling zucchini and summer squash. It's super simple. You get a grill nice and hot and just throw the squash on whole. Don't do anything to it. Maybe oil it if you want, but you don't have to really do that even. You turn it once in a while, but what you're looking for is a deep all over char. Like the outside should be burnt and you want that level of color with the insides just cooked. Then you take them off, cut them into big fat chunks, and while they're still hot, toss them in a bowl with salt. Add vinegar or lemon if you want, oil or butter, and let them cool a little bit, and they'll just sort of suck in those seasonings. And you can add herbs or cheese or nuts or whatever. But the cool thing is, this way they keep, like the squash will keep its natural sweet flavor, and it'll stay super, super juicy, but with that little bitter note of char to keep it interesting. I love them this way, so give it a try. Coming up.
Each one of these taste tests have been fun, but also kind of punishing in their own ways. I mean, when you eat so many of something, like, you start to have visions, you start to hallucinate. It's a lot. It's just a lot.
That's Washington Post reporter Mara Judkis with an in-depth analysis of hot dogs. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We are all about summertime eating today. And, okay, so remember a few minutes ago when we talked with Allison Roman, and she said she loves hot dogs? And I said, oh, hey, we just had a 20-minute conversation about hot dogs. Well, that was a very sophisticated literary device called foreshadowing. Mara Judkis is a food and culture reporter for The Washington Post and their website, Voraciously, which seems appropriate, considering that one of the things she did at work recently was lock herself and a bunch of her colleagues in a room and eat a ton of hot dogs. But it was for journalism, to tell us all which ones you really want to bring to your next cookout. Hey, Mara.
Hi.
I am so excited to have you here because there is something I really need to talk to you about. I need to make sure you're okay. Because you work at the Washington Post, where the slogan is, "Democracy dies in darkness." It's the most intense slogan I've ever heard in my entire life. And yet you are, like, possibly obliterating your own health for us by doing these massive taste tests of hot dogs and frozen pizzas. Like, are you okay?
You know, I ask myself that question every day, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also ask for hazard pay whenever I do these. So far, all of my requests have been denied.
Okay, so tell us about how these taste tests got started and how's it been going?
So we do these taste tests for Voraciously, which is our vertical for inexperienced cooks, people who are millennials who are wanting to learn more about food. And, you know, a lot of that is recipes, but we also have a slight focus on consumer packaged goods. And so we started doing these mega taste tests of products that people often buy. And so we started with macaroni and cheese, and we did frozen mac and cheese and also the boxed mac and cheese. And then we did frozen pizza. And then we moved on to hot dogs. And each one of these taste tests have been fun, but also kind of punishing in their own ways. I mean, when you eat when you eat so many of something, like, you start to have visions, you start to hallucinate. It's a lot. It's just a lot. We love it, though.
Let's talk about hot dogs. You know, I don't have, like, a lot of blind faith in the invisible hand of capitalism, but I kind of feel like so many people eat hot dogs, so many people make them, there has to be, like, a baseline for how good they are, right? Is there such a, are there truly bad hot dogs out there?
Yes. I can tell you with authority.
Oh, God.
Yes, there are bad hot dogs.
Depressing.
We tried a few of them. Yeah. Yeah. So we did this in a pretty scientific way, or at least as scientific as you can get about a hot dog taste test, which is probably not very. But, you know, we do our taste test blind. We don't want brand names or branding of any sort, or people's, you know, people's association with certain brands that they grew up eating. We don't want that to color the taste test. So every taste test we do is blind. We have people score things on a numerical scale. And so in this case, we did taste, appearance, and seasoning balance. We were looking for, like, a good blend of sweet and spicy and salty and smoky. And then for hot dogs, we also did snap, which is, like, how they should feel in your mouth. Like, a good hot dog should have a casing that bursts just a little bit, but not too much. You know, you don't want to be, like, chewing your way through it. It should just have, like, a little snap when you bite into it. And so those were our four factors. And then people also wrote in comments, too. And that's kind of where the fun comes in.
And what did you find?
So our number one hot dog was a big surprise to us. You know, we have all of the store brands that people know and love. We have Oscar Mayer's, we have Dietz and Watson, Hebrew National, all the brands that people tend to really know and think about when they come to their summer barbecues. And then we also put in a few of the kind of upscale fancy brands, like Neiman Ranch was one of them. Mm-hmm. Wellshire is another. Rosetta Farms, like a fancy hot dog there. And then a few other store brands like Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, Costco, and Safeway. And so we have a good mix of all over the map. And I think, you know, when you first go into one of these things, you kind of think that one of the fancy brands is going to win. It's just an association that people tend to have. Like, oh, it must be better. It's, like, branded. It has this farm. It's packaged.
It's bougie,
it's a higher quality meat.
You know, artisanal or whatever, blah, blah,
Exactly. Yeah. But it turns out that's not exactly what people think they want in a hot dog, maybe. People want the classic hot dog. And the classic hot dog, I think, is, like, a little bit more artificial tasting. So our number one winner,
you want it to taste
a little bit
tang.
Fake. Yeah. Exactly. So our number one winner was actually Costco's house brand, the Kirkland beef hot dogs. And I can
tell you,
they're really good. They're really
good.
Are
you serious?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I would buy them all summer long.
I grew up going to Costco for my groceries, and I've eaten more than one of those hot dogs. And, like, I don't think of them as being, like, the childhood hot dog, though. Like, so, convince me of this.
Okay. Yeah. So the things that we liked about the Costco hot dog, you know, I mean, first of all, it is kind of insane that the best hot dog could come from a place where you can buy, like, a 36 pack of toilet paper. but the things that people loved about them was that they were just the quintessential hot dog. They weren't trying to do anything special. And that was where some of these other brands fell short. Like, our least favorite brand, the one that came in 15th place, was Neiman Ranch. And people absolutely loathed this hot dog. Yeah, because it had this, like, It was a little too sweet, and it had this kind of fake smoky flavor. It was like almost maple-y. Like people, they were just trying to do too much. Like people just want a hot dog to be a hot dog. And so a Costco hot dog, like it has a pretty good snap. It has like a really good seasoning blend. Like it's a pretty balance between the sweet, the spicy, the salty, and the smoky. It doesn't have quite as much of that artificial smokiness to it. It was just kind of, it had everything kind of put together in a way that was, I guess I would say, almost in a neutral way. You know, like your hot dog also, you don't want it to compete with your condiments too. You don't want it to compete with your bun. Mm. It just had a really pleasing balance of everything. Like a balanced hot dog is really what ended up being the best in this competition.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, so it wasn't like extraordinary. It was just sort of like the platonic ideal. It was like kind of in your memory what a hot dog should be.
Exactly, yeah.
Were there other surprises?
So Nathan's from Coney Island came in second. I think we had thought that Nathan's would have come in first, actually, if I had been placing bets. But, you know, I think it's the same for Nathan's. Like, people thought it was really well-balanced. Nathan's is a little bit thinner. The Costco ones are thicker, which some people liked more, I think. There's just a little bit more hot dog to it. And Oscar Mayer came in third, actually.
Really?
Let's see, what else? Yeah, Oscar Mayer, third place, and Trader Joe's came in fourth.
Oh, all right. So Costco, Nathan's, Oscar Mayer, and Trader Joe's, rounding out the top four.
Yeah, yeah. And Hebrew National, that came in pretty low. They ranked 11th. Tasters just said that it was, it had kind of a dull flavor. It was too salty. It had more chew than snap. So that one was kind of a disappointment.
Oh, so sad. Well, they answer to a higher calling, so maybe someone else will jump in. Thank you, Mara, for all of your personal sacrifice and bringing us this news.
Thanks for having me.
Mara Judkis is a food and culture reporter for The Washington Post. You can find the results of their hot dog tasting at splendidtable.org. And they really put in the work, so don't let it go in vain. Okay, so I don't know how much he's going to like me doing this, but I'm going to tell you that our next guest, Andy Baragani, walked into the studio a solid 25 minutes late for his interview. But he apologized graciously and profusely, and honestly, he had a great excuse. He was shooting another video for Bon Appetit's YouTube channel, and that means if you don't already know him and love him, you will soon. He's warm, kind, and a hell of a cook. And he just did a big feature for the magazine all about grilling fish, so we were extra happy we waited for him. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I am excited for all of our guests, but in particular excited to have you here today.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
Well, I have to say there's a specific reason, and that is that I am about to go visit a friend's beach house where like all we do is grill fish.
Oh, I see where you're going.
It's a little bit functional. It's a little transactional. I'm sorry. And, you know, I feel like I do it okay, but mostly I just like, I get the grill ripping hot and I throw in the fish and I kind of just pray it comes out. But you actually know how to grill fish. So
I do. I'm well aware at this point.
What is rule number one?
I think rule number one is, I guess, it depends on what type of seafood you're cooking. But if you're going to go with fish, rarely do you want to go with high heat. Or actually, I never go with high heat. And for that matter, I actually rarely go with medium-high heat. I'm more of a medium-heat type of guy, just so that the skin gets crisp but doesn't char to the point where it's just almost inedible.
I love that you're a medium-heat kind of guy. I feel like I'm a medium-heat kind of guy.
Yeah, moderate.
Generally.
Yeah, gentle.
Yeah, gentle. I'm a gentle guy. But for fish, so, okay, you know, obviously, like, fear number one with grilling fish is sticking.
Yes.
And so I was always trained, well, if the grill is super hot and you oil the grates, then that's what prevents the sticking.
I would say that's part one. I definitely think you need to get your grill pretty hot. And then from there, make sure it's very clean as well. It's easiest to clean the grill when it's hot. So okay. I don't know if people are aware of that. So once you clean the grill and it's hot, then you want to slick it with the oil. But as soon as you slick it with the oil, that's when you want to put your seafood on immediately. You just created a non-stick surface. Mm. But what I do is I not only oil the grate, I oil the fish. So okay. It's kind of like a insurance policy, like double duty in that regard. I would rather go a little bit longer on medium heat than go medium high, high heat and get kind of the tail and the head, especially if you're doing whole fish, burn before you have the everything cooked through in the center. It's just safer that way.
And do you have any rules for like always skin on, sometimes skin off is okay?
I think you should always go skin on. One, because who doesn't like crispy skinned fish? That's like one of my favorite things on the planet, I think. But also, it's a barrier between the flesh and the grates.
Yeah. And do you cover the grill or no?
It depends. With whole fish, I usually don't cover it. It depends on the size. I'll just flip it once. I have a particular method of flipping that we could get to later. But when it comes to just like a skin-on fillet of salmon, I actually just leave it skin side on the grates the whole time, and I cover it. So I ensure that the skin gets crisp, the flesh is cooked through, and I just could pick it up without having to flip the fish at all.
Mm. Let's not wait about flipping.
Okay,
tell me about flipping.
So I think when you're dealing, it depends on the size of the fish. I really don't like to deal with too big of a fish when grilling because it's too heavy. It's too hard to pick up. Mm. Doesn't matter how strong you are. It just gets a little bit tricky. And what I do is I kind of lay the whole fish facing you. So you want to kind of go against the grates crosswise. And then I use two large metal spatulas. That's the tricky part. You really want to go with two large metal spatulas. Mm. And what I do is I kind of pick the fish up, starting from the tail and head, and scoot forward with the metal spatula and then kind of roll it away from you. Mm. So it doesn't really, you're not actually lifting the fish up from the grates entirely. You're just kind of rolling it away rather than and flipping it that way.
Oh, okay. So like let the roundness of the fish help you out.
Exactly.
Right? You can roll it over rather than try to do the big like flip thing, which
never seems
ends
to
up
work.
Tearing it.
Yes.
Oh, right on.
It's a little bit technical, but once you get the kind of movement, which we kind of break it down in the story, it just ends up making a lot more sense.
Okay, if you're in a fish market, what would you look at and be like, let's grill that, let's not grill that?
I would go for a round fish. So that means basically where you are seeing the, this is kind of a weird way to describe it, but I'm kind of a funny character or a little odd one, where you can round fish as in you'll see the two eyes on either side.
Okay.
And I go with snapper, black bass. Those are kind of the two fish you'll find that are really easy to grill. I am not grilling flounder, for mm-hmm. example. It's just too thin. It's, I feel like you're more likely to, there's too much risk involved, I feel.
But just really delicate.
Too delicate, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And with fillets?
With fillets, I think salmon's a good one. You're never going to, rarely going to cook a whole salmon. They're just so big right. and hard to deal with. That's my favorite, especially because like I love salmon skin. You could do halibut, but I don't really care for halibut skin. Mm. I don't think anybody really does. And cod, it's really tricky to find it with the skin on. Salmon's my go-to, I think, for that, when you're doing fillets.
Yeah, especially in the summer. You have, like, all the beautiful king salmon, yeah. and sockeye salmon coming from Alaska.
Love sockeye salmon.
It's my favorite. Okay, there's one more question I have to ask you, because Sally, my producer, was like, ask him this! I've been dying to know this!
Does it have to do with seafood? It doesn't. Oh, here we go.
About squid. And I actually feel her on this. I love beautiful, like good charred mm-hmm. grilled squid. But I've never gotten a good color on squid without overcooking it.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that many, many times. I did try to solve that problem. And it's something that I picked up really when I was working in restaurants is I place a wire rack, kind of like a resting rack you would use. Mm. I put that directly on the grill. And the grates, or the wire rack is a lot more finer than the grates of a grill.
Okay.
And so I use that to grill the squid. So I don't grill the squid directly on the grates, gas or charcoal. I do it on a wire rack. What I do is I don't oil the rack, but I do toss the squid with a little bit of oil. And my trick, always a little bit of garlic, because even when you're dealing with good squid, I just kind of want a little bit of like scent of garlic with it, mm-hmm. just cooked. And then I go roaring high heat. I mean, this is not the time for medium heat or medium high. I put the wire rack on the grill and I let it go preheat on high heat for at least 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
I want it to be very, very hot.
White hot.
Yeah. So you're definitely going to get color. And it's also one of those things where you don't need to be so delicate with it. Like, you can move the tentacles around. You can move the bodies around. I also keep the bodies intact. I don't cut the bodies up. Mm-hmm. So they kind of tubular-shaped bodies, if people are not aware. And then the tentacles, I just, I don't cut them. I leave them whole. And I just kind of flip them around, and then I wait till the bodies get a little bit of color, and tentacles get a little bit kind of lacy and crisp at the ends.
Mm.
And you're good to go.
That's delicious. I can't wait. I can't wait for my beach house.
I know.
Well, thanks so much for coming in, Andy.
Thank you so much.
Andy Barigani is a senior food editor at Bon Appetit, and you can read his feature on grilling seafood in the June-July 2019 issue. And you can go to splendidtable.org for some of his recipes. Garlicky grilled squid with marinated peppers, and crispy skinned salmon with whole lemon sauce. Coming up...
So we're taking on a summer classic, homemade chocolate chip ice cream sandwiches.
That's Lon Lam of America's Test Kitchen. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So, look, I don't want to be a Midsummer Grinch and slander the ice cream sandwich, because any cookout to which you bring an ice cream sandwich will be a grateful cookout. But if we're honest with ourselves, most homemade ice cream sandwiches kind of fail as sandwiches, right? The cookies are too hard, and so the ice cream squishes out when you bite into them. And actually, fun fact, my friend, the ice cream savant Dana Cree, once told me that commercial ice cream makers actually will make their ice cream sandwiches and then let them sit in the freezer for 6 months to help the cookies get squishy enough to eat. But America's Test Kitchen's Lon Lam has the key to great, homemade, biteable ice cream sandwiches that you don't have to wait half a year for. And Sally Swift got it from her.
Hey Lon, good to have you here.
Hi Sally, it's great to be back.
So you are here with, I think, a pretty perfect idea for summer entertaining, the idea of making your own ice cream sandwiches.
Yeah.
I mean, that's irresistible. They're childlike, you know?
I love them so much. They take me right back to childhood.
All right. So how did you guys go about taking on the ice cream sandwich?
Well, I started with our favorite recipe for a chocolate chip cookie because it's mm-hmm. so flavorful and it's really easy. And I made 12 perfect ones. I put ice cream in between, squished them, froze them, pulled them out an hour later, and they were terrible.
No. What happened?
They were just rock hard, and they're like, the first thing we noticed was they're really thick, and so you it was just so awkward trying to take a bite out of them, and ice cream would squish everywhere, but the cookie wouldn't break. It was we had
to
start from
scratch. Your tooth
would break. Yeah, for sure.
So what did you have to do to get that cookie to work? Did you give up on that particular recipe?
A little bit, but the breakthrough came when I bought some commercial ice cream sandwiches. And I took them apart and started digging into the cookie and breaking it up. And I realized they're all super wet. And I thought, well, is it water?
Oh.
So I started kind of adding water into the cookie dough. And eventually I realized what was going on was that the sugar in the cookie dissolves in the water. And that syrup that forms, it doesn't freeze at freezer temperatures.
Oh.
It stays soft, and that keeps the cookie just tender enough that you can take a bite, even if you're pulling those sandwiches straight out of the freezer like a week after you make them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you think about, you know, those classic super cheap chocolate ice cream sandwiches, and mm-hmm. the cookie always sticks to your fingers when
yeah.
you eat it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're soft.
They're wet.
Yeah.
And actually, the other thing I learned was that I didn't just have to put water in the batter. You actually have to let the ice cream sandwiches sit in the freezer overnight. And what happens is some of the water in the ice cream itself migrates into the cookie. So there's an overnight rest, but it just makes the sandwiches perfect. And For me, if I'm entertaining, I want to make everything one or two or even a week in advance and then just whip them out and, you know, wow people with this thing that required no last minute work.
Right, that's perfect. So it's funny, though, because, of course, you had the perfect chocolate chip cookie recipe that you had to revamp to turn it into a perfect ice cream sandwich.
Yeah, so... Oh.
How tragic.
Well, I learned so much from the test cooks who developed that recipe. The original recipe calls for browned butter, and browning your butter gives it so much more flavor, which is really important because at freezer temperatures, your taste buds just don't work as well. And so anything you can do to make those cookies more flavorful, you should absolutely do. And so I'm browning the butter for these cookies. I'm using all dark brown sugar instead of a combination of granulated and brown sugar. And that extra kick of molasses-y flavor from the dark brown sugar, it's really great. I'm using like three times as much vanilla extract.
Right.
A little bit of extra salt. And all of this is just to make sure that even though they're really cold, they're not going to taste flat.
Right. So is there, did you discover a perfect ratio of ice cream to cookie?
Yeah, I spent a bit of time.
How did I know that?
Right. I spent a little bit of time just measuring the dimensions of commercial ones because they've really nailed it. And what we figured out was we want, you want about, gosh, about an inch of ice cream. And so in order for the amount of cookie to be right, you want really thin quarter inch thick cookies. And what's nice about this batter or this cookie dough, I'm calling it a batter because it's so loose, it almost looks like a batter, is that it spreads really easily. And so you get these nice flat cookies and you don't have to flatten them or shape them. You can just kind of plop them on your cookie sheet, bake them at a slightly lower temperature, and they'll just spread and flatten into these perfect circles.
All that water was kismet.
Yeah.
That addition.
It really was. It's weird that the water was the key.
Would you have advice on how to get the ice cream in the middle? And also, what, like, is there a type of ice cream that works? Is high fat better? What did you discover about the ice cream part?
So I was working with vanilla ice cream for most of my testing because it's easy and no one ever objects to vanilla with chocolate chip cookies.
Right.
And what I figured out was that you want kind of a 2-inch ball of ice cream, so like a nice hefty scoop. And when you put the ice cream on the first cookie and make the sandwich, you want to use your fingertips to kind of squish everything together. And that's because you can't press as firmly with your fingertips. They'll kind of bend, whereas your palm won't. And that helps you apply pressure more evenly without deforming the cookies because they're really soft and you don't want to break them while you're squishing. And I think your best bet is to pick your favorite ice cream and kind of think about the flavors of what you'd want to eat with the cookie. I don't think you can go wrong. Like if you like it, you put it between those cookies. But when you take the ice cream out of the freezer, take your finger and just press the top. And if you can kind of make a depression without applying much pressure, you can probably just scoop and go. But if the ice cream is really hard and your finger doesn't leave a depression, pop that container in the fridge and pull it out in maybe 15 minutes. That'll let it kind of soften more evenly so that you're not melting the outsides while the center stays rock hard, which is what happens when you leave it on the counter.
That makes total sense. So what is the next combination you're going to be working on?
Oh, man, I hope my bosses
are listening.
I have
dreams for you.
This is my favorite game. I started thinking about it, and I would love to try a snickerdoodle. Like, the spices on the outside, like cinnamon's classic, but you could probably do other spices, and all of them would go great with ice cream. Maybe some chocolate, like a cinnamon chocolate sugar cookie combo sounds fantastic to me.
That sounds fantastic, too. Can I put in a request?
Yeah.
How about a ginger with lemon ice cream?
Ooh, that sounds great. Yeah.
All right. You get to work and get back to us, okay?
Will do. I can't wait.
Thank you, Lon.
Thank you.
Lon Lam is senior editor of Cooks Illustrated and a recipe developer for America's Test Kitchen. You can find that recipe for homemade ice cream sandwiches at splendidtable.org. Okay, so what do we have? We've got our meat and vegetables, the fish, the hot dogs, and the ice cream sandwiches. Now all we need for our dream cookout is the drinks. What if you've got some under 21s coming, or a mix of drinkers and non-drinkers? Well, the Kitchen's Sheila Prakash is here with some great ideas for alcohol optional mixed drinks. Hey Sheila, so I have a pop quiz for you. You are heading to a cookout this Saturday. There are people from 15 to 55 years old. It is 81 degrees and sunny. Your car is traveling west at 53 miles per hour. What drinks are in the back seat?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is I'm probably going to have something super refreshing. I'm thinking Italian sodas could be really fun. San Pellegrino is kind of like the original, and they make this one can. It's called Limonata, lemon. And those used to be pretty hard to find, but now, honestly, like your corner bodega will have them. And they come not only in just the lemon flavor, but now they have blood orange and grapefruit, and they kind of look like soda. So they're totally like kid-friendly, but they're not as sweet as American sodas. And they're just a really fun base for both a fun drink for people who are not drinking and a fun drink for those who are drinking. I think you could pour that into a pitcher, maybe muddle some herbs in there. So before you pour it into the pitcher, you could take some basil or mint, kind of throw it into the bottom of the pitcher, use a spoon or something to sort of press down and release their oils. And then you're going to want to pour the sodas into the pitcher. There you have a really easy two-ingredient mocktail right there. Non-alcoholic, really refreshing. For those who did want to add something to it, then you could leave a bottle of gin or vodka by the pitcher, and people could sort of spike their own glasses. I think that would be really fun and so easy.
Okay, so general cookout idea is you can make a nice drink that anyone can enjoy and then leave a bottle of a clear spirit, a brown spirit, you know, a whiskey, or like you said, a gin next to it. And if people want to have a little spike, they can go ahead and do that.
Exactly. I mean, you could even leave out a chilled bottle of sparkling wine, like a Prosecco or a Cava. That could be fun if you still want the option for those who kind of want to add a little alcohol to their glass. And you're not making, you know, two or three different options for everybody, and you're also not serving them, so you can go and do your thing and it's out for them to help themselves.
Okay, so the Italian sodas are great, but what are some other good like sources of flavor or bases that you like to build a drink around?
Another one is tea. So I mean, you could do just plain black English breakfast tea. You could cold brew that, just stick the tea bags, or if it's loose tea, put it into like a pitcher, fill it with water, stick it in your fridge for a few hours to overnight until it, you know, is tea, iced tea, basically. You didn't even have to heat up water. So you can do that for black tea. You could do that for herbal teas, which I'm really into because I find them even more refreshing this time of year. And then you could use that as a base. And you're not just serving people plain old iced tea. So if you had black tea, black tea and bourbon could go really well together. So again, I'm thinking of like, I think you always want to add one more extra element. And I think especially this time of year in the warm weather in the summer, herbs are just a natural thing to reach for. You might have a small herb garden or pot outside where you're growing those things. So mint, again, could be really great here. You could kind of muddle that in, pour the tea, and leave that out. Maybe a big squeeze of lemon could be nice. And then use that as just a refreshing drink for kids and those who aren't drinking alcohol. And then again, leave out a bottle of whiskey or something. Like rye could be nice. I think bourbon or rye, a brown spirit for black tea. And then using that to spike it. And then on the other end, the herbal teas, like I mentioned, those I think would go much better with the clear spirits, like gin and vodka. Chamomile comes to mind, and jasmine tea. I think both of those, they're kind of just, that has that beautiful floral aroma that could be really nice and complex. And another one I'm really into is lemon verbena. It's a little harder to find.
Oh, I love it.
Most grocery stores aren't going to carry it. It is my favorite. You can find it online, and most, it's usually in loose leaf. And it's beautiful. It's kind of lemongrassy. And that is really nice with gin as well.
Yeah. Lemon verbena, I love so much.
So good.
Like you said, it has a sort of a lemony flavor, sort of a lemongrassy flavor, but also like a little bit more depth, a tiny bit of bitterness.
Mm-hmm. It also goes really well with lavender. You can buy lavender to cook with. It's dried. And I found it's super nice when you're making these cold brew teas. So I'll put some of the lemon verbena leaves in like a water pitcher and then kind of a big spoonful of the dried lavender. And then it's like a lemon lavender cold brew tea. Super nice.
And that sounds great with a little splash of gin.
Exactly.
What about drinking vinegars? I think you're really into those, right?
Yeah. So drinking vinegars, kind of a funny name for it. Like, oh, vinegar, you're drinking vinegar. But they're also known as shrubs. So they have been around for a long, long time. It's a way of kind of preserving fruit. And so you kind of mix fruit with a vinegar. It's usually a neutral vinegar, like apple cider vinegar or white wine vinegar, and sweeten it with sugar. And what comes up out of it is this really nice vinegar that has the essence and flavor of whatever fruit you're using. They're easy to make at home, but honestly, there are so many cool brands right now, so you don't have to do it yourself. There are a lot of really nice, like, local people that are doing it in communities with their own local fruit and coming up with some really cool combinations. They're basically like a syrup of sort, but they have
a much more sour component.
Yeah, so you can't drink it on its own. It is mostly vinegar, so it's going to be too strong to drink as is. So it needs to be diluted. So it is automatically the perfect base for a refreshing drink without alcohol. So, you know, maybe just a generous splash in a glass and then top it off with, you know, club soda, tonic water, and that's going to be a kind of a soda in a way, but not as sweet. It'll have a little bit of sweetness to it, but it'll have that sort of vinegary tang that makes it really unique and also makes it incredibly refreshing. And then again, it has that complexity to be a base of a actual cocktail. So depending on the flavor profile of that shrub that you're using, you could easily spike that drink with a spirit. Or like I said, even a sparkling wine could be really nice.
Sounds great. Do you have shrubs, like particular brands? I know you mentioned that there are lots of different brands and some of them are regional, some of them are local, but are there particular ones that you love?
Yeah. So there are so many. I feel like every time I'm in a cool specialty store, I see something new in the shrub department I want to try. But two of my favorites are, there are two women-owned brands. The first is Mother Shrub, and she's based out in Virginia. And she makes this one, it's a salted honey shrub. Usually you're seeing it with fruits, but this one is, she's using local honey and local salt, actually, to make this. And it's savory, sweet, tart. It is so hard to describe, but it is so refreshing and so delicious. That's really fun. If you're going to spike that, would be really fun with like a bourbon. But even just that with lots of like lemon juice and tonic water would be really, really nice. And then the other one I'm really into is a brand called Girl Meets Dirt. And she is out. It's like the best name I know. I wish I had come up with it. But she's out in the Orcas Island, which is this tiny island off of Seattle. Yeah. And so she, because she's in this really unique microclimate. I mean, the fruits that she's using are super special, and all these beautiful orchard fruits, plums and peaches. She does a lemon lavender. Again, I like that combination a lot. I really like that. Yeah, yeah. She has a rhubarb that's really nice. She has this ruby spiced apple that's nice for the fall. It's apples that she has in her orchard, and she's spicing it with like the warm, you know, the warm fall flavors, cinnamon and nutmeg, which is really fun as well. So those are two brands that I'm really into currently. But honestly, I mean, even just going to your local farmer's market, you would be surprised. There's probably somebody selling a shrub or a drinking vinegar there.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Sheila.
You're welcome.
Sheila Prakash is a food writer, recipe developer, and an editor at The Kitchen. You can find a link to her piece on drinking shrubs at splendidtable.org. With that, we hope you feel ready to host the cookout of the year. Have a great one, and we'll be back next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media,
Thanks so much to everyone who supports our show and public radio in general. And if you like to, it's easy. Just go to splendidtable.org/donate. Subscribe to our podcast at our website or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lupi is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Special thanks this week to Argo Studios and our friend Paul there. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.